Der ZZF-Podcast.
Emergency Archiving.
Aus dem Leibniz-Zentrum für zeithistorische Forschung in Potsdam.
Welcome to this special edition of the podcast from the Potsdam Center for Contemporary History, or ZZF Potsdam for short, in the German language. I'm your host Tim Schleinitz, and I say thank you for joining us today. Under normal circumstances, this program is in the German language and informs you about current research projects from Potsdam. But, to put it mildly, many notions of normality have been challenged again and again in recent times, and for many people, life is no longer normal at all. On February 24th, Russia attacked Ukraine in violation of international law. The Russian army's brutal violence against civilians is already being investigated, while new atrocities seem to occur on a daily basis. Photos that are said to bear witness to horrific war crimes are shared on social media. At the same time, many people are using Telegram or Twitter to organize and coordinate humanitarian aid, as millions of Ukrainians have had to leave their homes and flee. These stories and the images produced by the war are shocking and heartbreaking. It is important to preserve them for later prosecutions, but also for later research. My three guests today are doing just that. We agreed on English as a lingua franca, so I figured let's do the whole episode like this. Today's edition could be described as a special report from the historian's workshop during extremely precarious times. All over Ukraine, people are trying to continue their work while their country is subjected to outrageous military aggression. Historians and other scholars try to protect cultural heritage, archival documents and research data. Others intend to document the war and collect data about mass human displacement, about resistance and volunteering. This data is to be used for future research and science communication, but also for educational and exhibition purposes. This is really important because historical research depends on one fundamental necessity, the existence of remains from the past. In the sense of what bits and pieces, written lines and personal recollections, photographs, buildings or ideas from any given time period are accessible to us in our present time. In short, which historical sources have been handed down to us? From these surviving remnants of the past, history emerges. At the university, I was taught to always critically assess those sources, to not confuse them with a neutral window into days gone by. Instead, we can only take glimpses into the past by finding questions that make those sources speak to us. Whose perspective do they represent? In what context were they produced? Why is this particular source important to me and not a different one? Is this even a historical source or just, well, old trash? What survived by chance, what didn't? And finally, what was deemed worthy of being kept safe for us to find? And on the other hand, what was not? Those are all important questions that need to be accounted for. At least if we don't want to give in to arbitrary statements about our past and how our present came to be. Those questions and their possible answers already fill countless books, and they have inspired entire schools of historical thought and scholarship. In times of mediatization and digitization, however, new questions arise, especially with regards to the archiving of everyday life. For example, can we even archive social media? You can imagine, a lot has already been lost and much more will be lost. Today's guests had to pose such questions to themselves under dire circumstances. They work at the Lviv Center for Urban History in Ukraine. Our research center in Potsdam has been cooperating with Lviv for a couple of years now, especially in the context of an international research project on the legacies of communism. This podcast episode is dedicated to their work in times of war. I never thought I would say such a sentence. But before we go into details, the first two of them introduce themselves, as is the usual case in this podcast.
My name is Taras Nazaruk. I work here at the Center of Urban History in Lviv. I'm mostly involved in digital history projects. One of them is Lviv Interactive. And currently I'm working on archiving the telegram of the war in Ukraine.
My name is Oleksandr Makhanets. I'm working at the Center for Urban History as well. So I'm coordinating the project called Urban Media Archive, where we're working with digitizing some photographs, videos, and other medias to make them available for the historians. But at the moment, we are just focused on the collecting and the archiving the testimonies of war, visual testimonies, and also other medias.
My first conversation was with Oleksandr, who is working on the preservation of photographs, and Taras, who is archiving chats from the instant messaging service Telegram. First, I asked them, what value did history and historical methods hold to them during the first shock and aftermath of the Russian invasion of their country?
In the beginning, I was, I'm not a historian by training, although I work at the institution, which is academic institution in the field of urban history, and I coordinate a project that is related to the history of this city, Living Track, to the name of the project. My background is more in journalism and media studies. But still, I mean, at the moment, I'm working in this field more. And in the beginning, in those first weeks, I was, initially it was completely like irrelevant to think of history, to think of pre-war projects, to think about like anything that was our main priority and our everyday operational tasks before the war. Mm-hmm. And I was at a certain point, I just started thinking about this idea that the any kind of historical study and all those projects that we do at the center, we often keep saying that basically history could be as a kind of resource in order to talk about our current situation. The history is something that gives you potential to reflect on what is happening right now and build a discussion around that. So this is kind of history as discipline is a space where you can build this discussion. And in those first weeks of the war, I was asking myself how the project that I'm working on, Live Interactive, how history in general as a discipline could be the resource. What can we do as a historical institution at the very moment and how it could be relevant? And I actually couldn't find any substantial answer to that question, actually. And for me, in those first weeks of work, the first weeks of war, the most important seemed to be the humanitarian aid. So I don't know, volunteering, helping those escaping the war, organizing shelter, coordinating all the support initiatives coming from Western academic institutions, looking for funds to pay some, honoraria grants and everything to those who lost their jobs and something like that. And we still keep doing this, but it's at some point after, a few weeks, we also started thinking of what we can do beyond that, what we can also do as an academic institution in the field that we are professionally involved in. And then we came to those ideas of documenting, archiving as another thing that now for us feels as important as other initiatives that we are engaged in. I don't know, maybe you want to add something.
Yeah, like for me, as a historian, I was taught to be neutral in the research, and it's a very strange feeling when all the history comes to you personally here. So, and I think that's very important now in the process that we are doing, to be open and to talk that we are biased in this projects, that we are collecting the materials, but we still dependent on the circumstances, and also we are still dependent on our personal experiences. at the moment. So we are aware that we are collecting these archives for the future generations that will rethink these materials. But still, all these circumstances, they are shaping this archive, because we don't have some special access to other points of view, for instance, when we are collecting photographs. Also, we are limited by different objective situation, as we cannot order some specific topics for the photographers. So we are deciding that we are working, for instance, because I'm taking care of this direction on visual materials and visual testimonies of the war. So we decided that we will collect the materials from those who are already working as a photographers at war, because you need to have the permissions to take the pictures even in Lviv. It's a relatively safe place, but still there is no access to some locations and some processes that are happening now. So we are starting working and contacting photographers who are already doing their job for some medias or just for themselves. So that's one of our approaches where we're collecting these materials.
The desire of documenting the present was decisive for the projects of emergency archiving. This begs the question, what is different if we preserve the present instead of analyzing the past?
I think it's pretty much the same when we are working with the past, because we are also limited with some sources, and now we are also limited with some sources that we have access. Also, we had the experience of collecting some archives since pandemic started. So, but it was that time we had much more time just to spend at home. So we were free to experiment with open calls. We also trying to collect some private photographs from the cell phones and so on by the open call and show this private perspective of the war. But still, we also understand that a lot of people are busy, they're not ready to share at the moment. And also, we are not going to publish those materials now, because we cannot predict how those materials will be used. Also in terms of authorship, because someone could be, it could put someone in danger.
So this is also like an initiative that you started aimed at preserving, so to speak, about getting like sources, analog sources within the digital realm to make them available over time, I guess. Yes. Does this aspect of preservation has changed during the start of the war? Has it become more like urgent because maybe institutions are being attacked or something like this?
So the first step was the backup. So because we have our own server at our venue here, but we never had enough resources to have another server somewhere else, like abroad or on some cloud storage. And we have the system administrator who helping us to back up these materials, and also our colleagues in the institution from the other side, that they are receiving those materials to their server. So that was like the first thing that we started, because no one was able to predict what will happen next. So, but for some other institutions, this is much more challenging, because a lot of institutions in Ukraine, they even when they have their collections, they don't have their servers. They are storing their archives on the hard drives, for instance, and it's much harder to preserve those digital files. So on the first months, everyone was thinking about how to back up, how to put the materials into safe place from the regions that are now under attack. Also some institutions started evacuating their collections or their materials. Also, we received like the tons of offers from other institutions from the Europe with the offer to provide some storage. So we were trying also a little bit to help and to manage this process for other institutions. Previously, that was very strange situation in Ukraine because there is no trust between the institution. Everyone wants to have their collections and they are afraid that someone will stole their collection when you are digitizing it, so they will lose the control over the materials. And now everyone just became more open because they are aware that it's very important to have these digital copies also in terms just to understand what they have, especially when it comes when we're talking about the photography, because some photography collections are stored on the negatives and you cannot view it simply, so you need to digitize. Also here we have some collections from, for instance, from Mariupol, because last 2 years we were actively working with the local museums and also local private collections to digitize their home videos, home movies, also from Mariupol. Mariupol is like for 1 month is blockaded totally. We don't have the contact with the people who we know there, with our colleagues at the museum, and we actually even don't know if they are still alive.
This is a horrible reality. Normally, scholars believe that some emotional distance to their subjects of research is important. But does this apply to extreme circumstances like this? Can and do we even want to maintain distance and neutrality in such times?
I think that the very initiative of archiving here at the center in general, particularly this web archiving of Telegram, this is something that became possible only because we are emotionally and psychologically biased and engaged. We are in the moment. And being affected by the situation, and this was also our response to psychological need to act, to do something in order to, well, to resist, to survive, to help others and everything. So this was our response, very natural response to do something. Mm-hmm. And archiving was one of the things. Maybe staying somewhere in a distance gives you more like balanced view on the situation, like view from above, seeing a broader picture. But at the same time, being behind the situation, being outside the situation, means that you can lack a context. And this is something that we have here, and we understand more what is happening here than someone from outside the situation. This is why we started archiving Telegram, actually, because when everything, when the full-scale invasion started, at the certain point when we had this discussion, what should we do? We also asked ourselves, are there any web archiving initiatives? Are there any projects trying to document what is happening online? And this is not something that we did before the war. This is completely new thing for us. We didn't have any background or professional training in web archiving, so this was another new initiative. So I basically started asking people that I know from other academic institutions, are there any web archiving projects about the war in Ukraine that one would work on? And I received some responses. People started, actually, there is Internet Archive Project, there is Danish Royal Library, Net Archivact project. There are other initiatives doing some web archiving, but they are mostly focused on either their local domains, I mean, Danish domain, UK domain or something, due to the legal restrictions, of course. Or they also are focused on news media, news websites, official representatives websites, something like that. And I realized that no one is looking at Telegram because no one is actually aware that there is something happening in Telegram. I actually specifically asked people about Telegram and no one responded to me that this is something that one would be interested to archive. And there was not that much previous projects about Telegram archiving in the world. Then I just decided that I should think of that and we should start some project on Telegram archiving, because I clearly saw that there is a lot of information and coordination, I mean, official statements, information, but also horizontal grassroots, bottom-up coordination between volunteers and people in general happening in Telegram, on this platform, in the Telegram channels, Telegram group chats, and everything. I've been following many Telegram channels by myself, and I since I started this archiving project, I actually was able to find even more different kind of chats that were established specifically for, well, during the war, since the war started, or some channels that switched themselves towards informing about the events and developments in the war. And this was very important and still is very important, the source of information. And it's a huge part of media landscape in Ukraine at the moment.
You really stressed the point that it's like, in some way, about the motivation and everything, it could be an advantage to be invested as much as you are emotionally and everything within the situation, because of this special kind of view from the ground that you are having as researchers also. So my question would be, Alexander, you've been working as a historian also before. Like, how do you choose which pictures or which Telegram channels to archive? Is this based on like emotional reasons, because this or that picture or topic like speaks to you, or is it also on the grounds of historical methodics or something, or is it a mixture of both? How do you do that?
There is definitely no some kind of emotional approach to the selecting of photographs. Now we are just trying to cover everything that we are able to find and to contact the photographers that are responsive and that are open for such cooperation. And at the moment we are just collecting, we are not publishing. So we are started describing some materials to make the annotation and so on, to have all the description to be able to publish it in the future. And it's also important to make those description at this moment when we still remember the events. So there is no emotional approach to the selection of photograph. We also realized that every photographer has its own way of seeing, its own way how they are taking the picture. And it also could be the important topic to discuss the work of the photographer during the war. So the places they are able to access, the topics they want to cover, and so on. And actually we have like between our colleagues, we have some internal visual seminar, and that was the topic to discuss in our next seminar, the approaches of different photographers. Also, we are trying to cover wider geography, because we have few photographers here in Lviv who are taking daily the pictures for us, but also we are contacting the photographers in other cities to have the wider geographical coverage to this archive. So we are not selecting some specific or iconic photographs that will be the topic for discussion in the future based on this collection. Also, we are not forcing ourselves to collect as much as possible. So we are just aware of our capacities and our abilities, because we have only few people who are working on these projects. So we realized very fast that we were not able to, I don't know, to collect everything. So we just want to have like the one archive that is shaped by these circumstances and also by our approach. And that's how we are working now. Probably in the future, we will try to contact the photographers more after they, because those who are working in Kyiv, for instance, in Kharkiv or other cities, they are really in extreme situation. So they are not able to communicate every day, not able to send us the materials, but because it's not the commercial use, it's for the future generations. Also, we are working with the historical photographs, we are able to think on a longer distance.
And for the Telegram channels that you choose to archive, do you have any buzzwords that you're looking for or something, or some categories that you are trying to cover?
When we started the archiving, well, there was no clear, direct methodology what we want to archive and what we should archive. It was basically, kind of curatorial decision made rather intuitively. The idea was to document those channels and group chats that could give more understanding of what was happening than it was visible from the nationwide media or television or somewhere else or from official statements. Because initially, in the first days of the invasion, there was, journalists and media, news websites, they were not able to respond that rapidly to what was happening, and coverage was, not as efficient as updates in the Telegram. And of course, official media, television in general, under martial law became basically, there were certain messages that they could translate to the nation, and a lot of messages that were not allowed to make public. So Telegram became more informative in that sense. You can find, military positions of Russian army and their pictures of those tanks and everything, where they are located. So there was a lot of information. It was chaotic. It was not verified for sure, but there was a lot. You wouldn't be able even now to find those first messages in Telegram that were posted in the first days of invasion. So they would be lost. And this is why we were thinking about archiving it. Another part of that was volunteering communication. Communication between those who help with the humanitarian aid, with logistics, transfers, evacuation, search for those missing in the bombed cities. And this was rather horizontal communication that was not visible in news media or official statements at all. People just communicate with each other in those chats and share the information about what was happening. And there was also a lot of things that seemed to be and still seem to be important to document. That's why we decided also to document those group chats of volunteers. So basically, these were two initial directions, and they appeared rather intuitively. And then we started collecting more and more. New channels came, new chat groups came, and everything. And at a certain point, I just having the list of those channels that we are documenting, I realized that there is certain logic in this list. There are topics and groups that I can separate with each other. And then I just made a grouping of the list and realized that we have news media, official statements, we have volunteering chats, we have so-called open source intelligence information. There was an idea also to document some evidences of war crimes. That is also present in Telegram as well. Different videos, different pictures, different graphic contexts, and terrible things are also present there. And it is collected into the archive as well. I'm not sure if it would have some legal basis to use it in some trials, but still we document it. There is also a group of Telegram channels and chats that deal with so-called information and propaganda or cyber wars, different data leaks, DDoS attacks on websites and communication around that. Something that is happening around these topics are also documented. We also want to make a shift towards local city channels or chats, because something that is happening in Lviv and something that is visible about the war from Lviv is completely different than the perspective in Kharkiv or perspective in, I mean, in Mariupol. I'm not sure if they have any internet connection anymore, but in other bombed cities or occupied cities, there are local chats, there are local Telegram channels where people discuss what is happening there on site. Mm-hmm. And we decided to cover geographically wide those smaller local areas and smaller local chats. And that is a huge group of channels about different towns and cities in Ukraine. And this is another, well, another focus that we prioritize so far.
Mm-hmm. With the photos, I guess the same as with Telegram is about this verification thing. So are you concerned maybe that, because it's also like a propaganda war, is it, are you concerned that this might kind of impact your work, maybe archiving stuff that might be like false information, so to speak, either on pictures or on Telegram? I guess this is then also an aspect for future historians in order to decide, okay, so this is maybe part of some kind of scheme and this is probably genuine.
Yeah, definitely. That's why we are doing archiving. We are not doing any kind of informing. So this is not the informational campaign. This is archiving campaign. And this is our opportunity, I mean, our effort to create a historical source. So the informational, I mean, misinformation, disinformation, data leaks, propaganda campaigns, it's there. And it is important to, be aware of that. So that's why we do not want to publish it by any means at the moment. There are also those legal issues with the authorship and copyright of the materials, which is not, I mean, I do not have clear answer how to deal with that. I have some ideas that probably at the moment when we finish, when we stop archiving, at least something what we should do is contact all the administrators of the channels. Mm-hmm. Which is around 200 channels at the moment, well, informing them that there was such an initiative and asking them for the consent of creating such an archive. And if there is an agreement with them, then we can store it. If they deny, then we need to delete it. At the same time, we think that we might also prepare some disclaimer or statement that could be shared throughout the channels that we archived, informing people and the audience of those channels that this was archived from that moment until that moment. Mm-hmm. And in case you are concerned that something was archived that you do not want to be archived and you want to withdraw this from the archival collection, you can contact us. In some cases, there are channels that do not exist anymore. That's why this is ephemeral. It disappears. And some channels were deleted from Telegram. And I'm not sure if they are collected somewhere else from apart from our archive. They might be not existing anymore in any other place. So this is also the case.
It may seem weird to you, but it is not only in this context that legal issues determine which sources historians can work with and how. Maybe you are thinking now, hey, but that's important. Of course social media should be archived for later research. Sure. However, privacy rights are also important and copyrights have to be accounted for. Such legal problems illustrate there are many challenges to emergency archiving. This episode just gives you a small insight into the challenges that digitization poses to archiving and to historical research in general. Some aspects of our lives can only be found in the digital realm, which is in turn dependent on physical storage media. But not all of it. Some sources are even more fluid and intangible, like the spoken word of personal recollections. My next guest from the Lviv Center for Urban History is creating new sources face-to-face in oral history interviews with refugees. Here, she introduces herself.
My name is Natalia Otrischenko. I'm a sociologist and research fellow at the Center for Urban History in Lviv. My background is methodology of sociology. I did my PhD in Kyiv in the Institute for Sociology, the National Academy of Sciences of Ukraine. Since 2016, I am coordinating oral history archive here at the Center for Urban History. But as a researcher, my main question is urban expertise, the way how it is negotiated, how it is discussed since late 70s till early 2000s, based on the case of Lviv.
When the war started, Natalia was on vacation. How she found her way back to Ukraine and back to the Institute was the first thing she told me in our interview. Before we talk about her work, I want to share this story with you.
I might start from some personal note.
Yes.
Because during the breakdown of this new stage of the war, because actually the war in Ukraine was going on since 2014, when the Crimea was occupied and when the war in Donbas and Luhansk region was actually started by Russia as one of the players behind this armed conflict. But in February 2022, actually we came into a new phase of this conflict with a full-scale invasion of Russian army into Ukraine. And back then, since mid-February, I was at my vacation in Tanzania. Actually, I am just returned from Kilimanjaro, and I was waiting in the Kilimanjaro International Airport for my flight to Zanzibar, and then from Zanzibar I had to fly to Kyiv, and there actually I found out about the full-scale invasion. We were with a group of other Ukrainians who were actually struggling to get back home. And it was a long story of getting back home into Ukraine. It took me 6 days actually to get from Arusha in Tanzania to Zanzibar, and then via Dubai, via Warsaw, via Krakow, via Peremyshl, back to Lviv. So I've seen actually like how this first day of the war mobilized people in Poland in order to help Ukrainian refugees. I've seen these waves of refugees and people in the railway stations of Kharkiv and Peremyshl. It's mainly women, because this mass movement has a woman face, usually. Women and kids and elderly people and animals. So I've seen all of the possible emotions on the faces of those people. And then it was like a long way back home. And on the evening, on the sixth day of the war, actually also had the other calendar. When you start to count the days of the war, you're not using the days of your regular calendar. You're not thinking about the days of the week. You're just thinking, okay, just one more day of this war. And on the evening of the sixth day, I was here in Lviv. And the next day I started just to organize my everydayness. And on the eighth day, I finally came to the office and start to get into this new reality.
Back in Lviv, she first created a backup of her most important research data, checked on her colleagues and helped refugees coming to and through Lviv. Her research institute is also harboring some 30 people who had to flee from other regions in Ukraine. As a researcher, she built her new project on a previous one, which she had started in 2014, during the Euromaidan revolution. Back then, she already referred to this practice as emergency archiving.
How is this emergency archiving, as you call it, is it any different than the work that you are doing like under normal circumstances, so to speak, with those oral history methods and everything? How is it different?
For sure, it is different. oral history developed rich methodologies in terms of how to conduct interviews with people about the events which happened in the distant past. So actually, the role of the distance for oral history is very important, because the time has to pass in order for people to shape their narratives and also to make meaning of them. So oral history, it's often about the present moment, the present state of a person who narrates about his or her past from this moment of time, exact moment of time. And usually the position from which person speaks defines a lot the way how he or she describes his or her life. In other case, this distance is minimal. So it's more about like anthropological or sociological interviewing of people. And this project, this initiative that we launched together with other colleagues from Poland, from the Institute of Philosophy of Sociology of Polish Academy of Science and Polish Society for Oral History, as well as the University of St. Andrews in the Great Britain and the Center for Contemporary and Digital History in the University of Luxembourg. So here is a group of institutions and for sure people, because institutions are about people who gathered together in order to conceptualize and enact this kind of project. Because as you might think, there are a number of like big challenges connected to the ethical part of this project, because what we aim here is not to re-traumatize people, but to empower them. Because also as here at the Center for Urban History, we have a shelter with people who are living here. We try to, for sure, we are talking with them on a daily basis. And therefore, we got this feeling of a need to express and to talk about these experiences. And also, like in the media, we had so many stories which emerged, which also shows us that there is a necessity to talk and to preserve these experiences for the sake of the future. At the same time, we reacted to the very first idea was like, we have to record these stories, but how can we do it in the most ethical and methodologically right way? So first of all, we designed our conversations in the anti-oppressive and participatory way, which meant that while we were thinking about possible design of the conversation, about possible topics which might be covered in this conversation, we focused a lot on the cognitive sphere. We did not want to talk with people about their emotions intentionally. We don't want to dig into this, like, what did you feel? How do you react on that? We'd rather talked about their deeds and something that they might observe. So at least focus on this this part of consciousness, which is more safe, if I might use this word, still fully acknowledging that the emotional part would not be like fully separated from it, because it's also we are all in a very emotional state, and therefore we have to be super cautious about it. We also focused on the way how person can construct his or her narrative, and giving as much power of construction of this narrative to the person, not to push them too far with other questions, but rather implies this tool of active listening and to not dig in too far into some topics which might be might trigger some negative feelings. Also, our narrators had the possibility to stop at any point. Also, we perceive the informed consent as a set of decisions, not as a one-time activity. So like at the very, like at the beginning of the conversation, we asked the person one more time, did she agree or he agree on being recorded? And then during the conversation, we asked a few times, do you want to continue? Do you want to proceed? And after the conversation, one more time, we ask, okay, are you fine with this story being preserved? And also they have a right to withdraw their consent at any moment of time. As part of our design of this project, we also intend to talk with these people for a second time when we can talk about this war in the past tense. And it is important for us that all our narrators agreed to the second conversation, which meant that for them, also after the debriefing, after the recording was done, we had these informal talks when we asked people about their well-being. And also we had the contact of psychologists who might help them when they have this need. So we are trying to balance as much as possible and also create the space for expression for people who need it. Because we also acknowledge that not everyone experience the grief on the same level. For someone, talking about this experience could be a very therapeutic experience. And our psychologist also said that it is kind of a secondary psychological help, which could be provided not only by psychologists themselves, but also by people who have the skills of active listening. And also we, as a group of researchers, we are also debriefing a lot because it's also about our mental health and about us being both interviewers and researchers, but also people who are in this reality, who cannot escape it, and who are also might experience a secondary traumatization. And therefore, we have group meetings every week. We also have a possibility to talk to each other in the office, like immediately after the interview, when you have these emotions and you need to channelize them. And some of the colleagues can help with just simply by listening to your experience. And therefore, we are working also as a team to reflect on our experience. And our colleagues from the St. Andrews University, they organized for us seminars every week, where we invited scholars who worked on trauma and violence and the research in the context of the war. And we already had three meetings, one with Zahira Aragueta Taribo, who worked on exhumations in Spain, and who also like talked to the relatives who were searching for their loved ones in these mass graves. We also had a meeting with Ivana Maček, anthropologist who worked on wartime Sarajevo when it was under the siege. And we also had a meeting with Nerina Weiss, who did her research on survivors of tortures of Kurdish people in Eastern Turkey. So we had like also this wider geography of various projects, which also help us to relate to some other geographies, to some other methodologies, to some other contexts, both in disciplinary way, but also the way how people like deal with the very practical issues, like remaining sane when you heard about such terrible things that happened.
You are having different functions at the time. I mean, you are, for those people you are talking to, as you said, you're like active listening. So kind of also offering some psychological way of maybe help. Then you're also like a scholar, which has some methodological implications. You also have to think about the future of those recordings, i.e. all those legal issues and everything that you have to cope with. So, how many people are there in this project? Like you described that there are also many different, like helping on different, like you are not just doing this project in Lviv, as I understood it, because you're also receiving help from other institutions, but like on the ground right now, how many people are taking part in recording those interviews? Are you like alone or one or two, three people? I don't know, because as you said, it's like things can happen during those interviews. And how many interviews did you do up to this point of the recording of this video?
Yeah, we had a team here, local team in Lviv, the people who are engaging in the recordings of interviews, but also like some of them are helping with transcribing of the stories. And those people also might experience simply hearing about other people's suffering might be very difficult. So we have this team in Lviv, so it's up to 10 persons here, like counting those who are transcribing and conducting interviews. We also have a team in Poland who are still waiting to start the field work. There we have at least four persons who are coordinating the process and also who are recruiting interviewers. And probably there would be around 10 persons who will do interviews there in Poland. In St. Andrews University, we have three persons who are dealing in organization of the seminars, but also providing us with methodological and ethical guidelines. So people just checked bibliographies, the recent works on trauma-informed research and the way how interviewers might behave during different phases of the interview, just before, during, and after. So they really helped with this methodological tips, if I might say it, so guidelines that they provided us. So just checking thousands of articles and selecting the most important pieces for us, which we actually used in our like everyday work while we were interviewing. So this self-awareness towards your personal well-being, the well-being of your narrator, and this different ways how you might react on certain situation, because not every form of distress is traumatic. When a person cries during the interview, it could be therapeutic as well. But you as a listener has to be very cautious in this situation and how you might deal with it. So it's also a part of our training and part of the things that we are discussing together in the team, but also we are really thankful for these guidelines that our colleagues provided us. And also the team from Luxembourg, there is a coordinator there who engages in these legal issues. Because as we are planning to have these materials collected and preserved here at the Urban Media Archive at the Center for Urban History, we also want to have a backup in Luxembourg University. Also, this gesture is very symbolic for us as well, as it also shows that our story is European story. And like simply being there as a collection, as an archive, also tells that, yes, we accept you as a part of this story. Other colleagues there, she engages in organization, all this legal part related to GDPR and other parts of data collection and preservation and archiving, which could be very different in different countries of the European Union, but at the same time, it has some kind of umbrella concepts, which might be important for us to take into account. And yes, so we have this very like specific work done by specific people, and it's really helpful to have this support.
yeah, I can imagine. It's really good to hear that you have this kind of support, actually widespread support during also those different across those regional borders also. As you said, so when you're conducting an interview like this, are those like one interviewer at a time, two interviewers, or like how does it happen, so to speak, those interviews?
So they are mainly face-to-face interviews with one person telling the story and the other person listening to it. We are trying to do them on spot, like with people being like in the same room, basically. But not everyone is available. Like some people are in another cities, but they still want to share. And therefore, we use Zoom or other platforms when we can talk to each other through the screen. But in this case, the person really has to be like in very good condition to talk. And we really believe that the person has a right to express himself or herself. But also, we have a duty to make this person feel as comfortable as possible, and also to really careful about the way how this data could be preserved, because it's our responsibility as scholars to make a space as friendly as possible for a person to express at the moment, but also for the sake of the future to preserve the story in the most ethical way.
When you say that it's your duty to find ethical ways to preserve the data, what would that mean for you, ethical preservation of the data? Would it mean like open access, controlled access, for which kind of projects, or what does it mean, like ethical conservation?
Yes, well, we have this controlled access already developed here at the center. So our oral history data, it is preserved online. It could be accessed online, but only after the person register in the system and access through the system. So at least it is possible for us to see who is interested and in what kind of stories. So, you know, it's also important for those people who decided to share, to make their voices heard, not to preserve them in the shelf without anyone seeing those stories, but also not to put them on the table when everyone can do whatever he or she wants. So basically, we had some kind of procedures already developed by the archives, mainly dealt with the Holocaust testimonies. We have this very general procedure already developed, but maybe it would be changed in the process, at least modified for the sake of this project as well.
You also said that if I understood you correctly, that you're having those interviews like face to face and about the current situation, but that your interviewees also have agreed on having like future interviews. Did I understand this correct?
Yeah.
This is also a methodological thing, I would assume. Now, I'm not too firm on like oral history methodics, but maybe in order to see how those memories are put in place, so to speak. That's the deal there, yeah?
Yes, it's very important for us, like, to have people agreeing on the second interview is very important sign that those interviews went well. So at least for them, they feel okay with their story to being preserved. And also, it is important for us to have the second meeting, because like people who narrated the stories now, it's a very specific moment of time, might change their mind in the future. And not to put them into the vulnerable position, but to empower them through the second meeting, when they might revisit the story and say, okay, I don't want you to preserve my first story, but it's okay for you to preserve the second one. But we really hope that people will be fine with us having these two stories, which for me, I've seen them rather as a continuation than the comparison. But at the same time, for a researcher, the issue of comparison might be really important, because when, for instance, the person recalls the first day of this new full-scale war, the 24th of February, when he or she recalls it a month afterwards or a year afterwards. And here, as I mentioned in the very beginning, the role of the distance could be crucial. And it also could help us, the scholars of memory studies, to see how memory works, how it shapes based on your current position as well, but also when you speak about event in the past tense, you have a certain way how you narrate about it, because it's already a closed story. And when the story is open-ended, then you are telling it in quite a different way. So for me, it's important on the very different levels, on the level of reassuring person's right to revisit his or her consent, which we received now, and also to see how the story developed, and also to check on the person and say, how are you feeling now? So on a very, very different levels, it is important to have this second story.
Yeah. You also mentioned that all those like different projects that you were also like having contact with, like the researchers doing those projects. You mentioned those projects of talking about, for example, Kurdish people who were like tortured in Turkey, or those findings of the mass graves of the fascist regime in Spain and so on. Are those moments more like in a methodological way helping you, or are they also like helping you also, like how to prepare, how to approach the people themselves? Or is it more about those, like what you said, like how stories are told, maybe on more like memory theoretical things, or how, like what are the things that you maybe can use, and what are the things that maybe you are altering or about to alter at the
moment? Yeah, like we are not talking now with people who are torture survivors or who are experiencing checking the mass graves, for instance. So we are not intentionally talking with those people now, but for us it is important to see the field, because those issues would be important in the future. So for us, being prepared to heard about different experiences and to deal with these stories which might emerge in the interview. So it is definitely helpful on this methodological level, but not straightforwardly, because like we are not intentionally talking about people experiencing violence, about people witnessing violence. So, the main focus of our interview is about everydayness. So we talk about like what people seen, what people heard, what people eat, how people sleep, how they communicate. So this very general questions which we see as not triggering one. But at the same time, you never know what could trigger a specific person. And therefore, we have to be prepared to step back when we see that there is a story which might be problematic for a person to deal with. And for us, it is important not to trigger them, and also to create the space where they can one more time express their narrative and through that empower themselves and also experience kind of a relief, which we experience as human beings when they are telling stories.
How are you finding the people willing to take part in those interviews? Are you having maybe a Telegram channel? Are you having posters put up? Is it by people who know people? How do you find those people willing to take part?
We have information about this project on our webpage of the Center for Urban History, but mainly we are using snowball sampling. When we have like every one of us has his or her a circle of connections, and we recruit people mainly through those connections, because we can ask, okay, we are having this project, would you be interested to talk? And people might think for a few days and then say okay or not. Also in my case, for instance, I had a person whom I interviewed, and she was really happy about this experience, and she recommended other friends, so like a classical snowball sample, to participate in this interview. And today I recorded like a second round, like her friend who really wanted to share. And also she see like a kind of a moral obligation behind it, like to share the story. And as she mentioned, quote, I wanted a future history textbook be written based on the stories of people who actually experiences it, end of quote.
How many interviews have you undertaken personally up to
Personally, okay, let me check. Up to now, we have about 28 interviews already collected by our team. But me personally, okay, let me see. I think today it was my seventh interview.
Okay. That's quite a lot of data for those kind of interviews, actually, like those qualitative approaches. It's about recording, I think, and it's at the time, it's not about like giving order to those interviews, so to speak. Is that correct? It's more about like collecting.
Archiving is also about like making order.
Yeah, okay.
Still,
yeah.
Like you have to name files somehow. Like you have to organize it like the shifting way, so you're not putting everything together in one folder and then trying to understand how to deal with this mess. So for sure, we are like organizing our materials in a certain way for the future archiving. We are not creating any tax system yet, but it is something that we will do for sure in the moment, because like different interviews might have different type of data, which falls into different legal protection in the European Union, for instance. Mm-hmm. Some people might mention about their mental health, which is about medical condition, which for sure had to be protected in a certain way. Some people might talk about some illegal activities, which are illegal for European Union, for instance, now, but it is something which is currently part of life. Some people might talk about like violence and other experiences. So for sure, we will create a tax system for those interviews in order to manage them better. We also have informed consent because some people wanted their stories to be preserved with their real names. The others wanted to have pseudonyms. The others wanted to be anonymized. So this information also has to be like clearly stated in order to work with this data in the future. So for sure, like now we are just collecting the stories. No analysis is made for sure. Also, we are just reflecting on the move. Just some ideas pop up and we just discuss them with other colleagues, but no writing on that. Just recording those stories because it is something that we would like to invest our current resources because our resources are also limited under these circumstances. And so it is something we see as important to do now.
Yeah.
But by the way, I said we did not make any research based on these materials, but what I already can reflect on is that the way how people express the experience of COVID pandemics being super helpful for them now, because a lot of activities were transferred online and people get so many new tools to work with and also some kind of survival experiences during this first weeks of pandemic. So there was a lot of comparison between Euromaidan and the current events and the beginning of pandemic and current events. Sorry if it was too messy because like I still do not have time to like sit and reflect on it and create at least like a very like a piece of paper when I state everything which is important for us, like self-awareness, like empowerment, like working like with these different ruptures and distresses and emotions. I just need time, but like it's super problematic now. Just sit and focus on something.
This concludes our special edition of the ZZF podcast. Me personally, I find the work of my guests from Lviv truly impressive and inspiring. And keep in mind, even in times of war, projects like this are done by a network of people. Funding is required and other resources too. Please check out their website for ways to support them. lvivcenter.org. If you happen to be a scholar yourself, the colleagues from Lviv are eager to engage in scholarly debates regarding research methods and an exchange of experiences and thoughts on the current situation. You can also listen to their podcast. It's called UA, The Day We Survived. Just be prepared. Those are stories from the war and therefore they may contain violence. Our colleagues from Lviv have taken a difficult task upon themselves, and an important one. Therefore, please spread the word. Tell others about these projects. They provide so much knowledge about Ukraine, and they also inspire us to reflect on the future of history and historiography. Thank you for listening and thinking along with us. Take care and all the best. Yours, Tim.